Welcome to the Theater of Others podcast. My name is Adam Marple, and I'm the co-artistic director of the Theater of Others. With the COVID-19 pandemic forcing a shutdown and reevaluation of space and gathering, we at the Theater of Others are thinking about what stories we need and how best we can share them. We believe space is psychology, and it informs the way in which an audience interacts and reacts to what is presented to them. We create uniquely theatrical events in bespoke sensory performance spaces crafted to encourage curiosity and grant the audience permission to commune with the play. Now that that space has moved online, how can we encourage interaction and action amongst an audience virtually? The Theater Brothers produces plays that both welcome and challenge the audience. We are committed to international collaboration and are a laboratory that helps artists grow through intensive study of their craft. The Theater of Others creates a shared community of artists and audiences for the purpose of exploring the most profound issues of our lives and times. We believe the play watches the audience. The audience is necessary, and they are witness to what happens. And you get to be witness to us making that happen. The purpose of this podcast is to open up our process and let you in. We're peeling back the curtain, so to speak, and encouraging you to follow along, to ponder, prod, and question, to join us and criticize us if need be. Being a witness is no passive task, and it requires much from you. Are you up for the journey? On the podcast today, from Melbourne, Australia, are co-artistic directors Rudy Miller and myself in Cairo, Egypt. This podcast contains explicit language.
Hi, Adam.
Hi, Booty.
How you going?
I'm doing okay. Yeah.
I think that's what I need to like. That's basically my theme music right now, because I no longer have pajamas on. It's just a robe.
Folks, he is getting progressively less and less confined to clothing in his quarantine. Got a beautiful robe that he is in. It's slowly opening up.
Yes, it's Japanese.
Yes.
I know, by the end of the podcast, everyone, I will be butt naked.
That's right.
I'm feeling freer and freer as the days go by. This is only day 4, so I can only imagine what day 13 is going to be like.
Yeah, we should do a podcast every single day and just listen to the sanity leave you as you stay in quarantine. Or the sanity grows, who knows, you know?
You know, it could be a durational piece.
Oh, wow. If only we had somebody to write that durational piece, right?
Oh, yeah. Wasn't Stephen Galtney going to write a durational piece?
He was also going to write a book. We're going to publish some things and another play. And yeah, there was all kinds of promises we made.
Well, luckily, we have Stephen Galtney on the line. Yay!
Stephen, who's doing all these things? Stephen.
Come on, you're a free man. You've got nothing but time on your hands. You don't have to do anything else, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, time is, on my side.
Yeah.
On my side.
Yes, 100%. Well, welcome back, Mr. Galtney.
Yeah, a year later.
It's good to be back. It's good to see you both, indeed.
Yeah.
It's been a journey listening.
Look, we've been shouting out to you for quite some time now.
Last couple podcasts, yeah.
So now it's an opportunity for you
to shout
to
back
have
at
a response
yeah.
to all the madness that has been happening on this podcast. With basically, you know, with you as our vehicle for entertainment. Is that bullying? Were we bullying you?
No.
No, I just think that there were moments during that rewrite podcast where I almost thought that I was on the podcast. I was just like, I think Stephen would say this and this and this. And I was like, maybe sometimes.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a really great way to start. So how did you feel about us when we were saying about you and the rewrites and what's coming up for you when we were talking in your stead?
I'm trying to remember the episode now. I agreed with what you both said. I feel like you were questioning yourself a lot and saying that I was gonna come on and disagree with all the advice you were giving, which is not the case at all. I think there was some discussion of talking about making me do rewrites, and that I don't like, I put up with rewrites. I don't know if you ever said I don't like doing rewrites. But I do remember thinking when I was listening to that of just, I remember thinking I do like rewrites sometimes. Mm-hmm. I mean, I agree with what you both kept coming back to, which is that a large part of writing is rewriting. Mm-hmm. And you know, if a play is a tree, you have to like plant it and let it grow a little bit, and that's the first draft before you can start to prune it and help it grow in the way you want it to. I think I might have mentioned this to you all in some forum since then, I can't remember. That sometimes when you guys, you know, quote unquote, make me do rewrites that I have to quote unquote put up with, I think part of the pain in my soul has more to do with timelines.
Yeah.
And just, you know, how much time there is to rewrite, what the circumstances are of those rewrites, as opposed to the idea of rewriting itself, because there's absolutely a joy in, you know, bringing a piece to trusted collaborators and getting their feedback and then rewriting based on that. But when you have, you know, a week before you're live, and you realize together that you need to like do a massive rewrite, and it's like, oh, I wish I had 2 years instead of 5 days. That's tougher. But that's the process, you know, of collaborative art, and of, you know, making theater is something that happens at a specific point in time. So it's like, you know, sometimes timelines are different than they would be for, you know, maybe a different movie.
The text message that you sent us the day after episode went live, you said something about how the majority of the time when you're in the room hearing it, you have the same note that I turn around and give you. And it's more about me kind of confirming something you were already thinking about rather than giving you something wildly out of the blue. What's it like when I do give you something wildly out of the blue that you weren't thinking about? Or when you're working with another director, or you're working with other people, and it's like, I didn't see that coming at all. I don't even know if I agree with that because it's so out of left field. What's that like?
That's definitely more rare, but it does happen. I think, at first, yeah, there's often something that rises up in the pit of your stomach where you're like, no, that's wrong. if I didn't feel it, it must not be real. just especially because like this is something that we're experiencing together. Yeah. Huh. So it's not a dissimilar feeling to like when you walk out of a play with, you know, a friend who you think you agree with about theater and like they
I loved it
and you hated it.
It was amazing.
What are you talking about? Did you just see the same thing I just saw? And they're like, yeah, and something different happened in me. So you have to kind of call that a little bit. But yeah, I mean, I think then it is sometimes the most difficult to listen when that happens, but also the most important to listen, because you have to not leap to judgment either way, you know, like they might have legitimately seen something that you were missing because you're so close to it, or because they're smart, or because, you know, whatever. Or they might just want something for the piece that you don't want for it. And it may be a moment that you need to like stand up for yourself and say like, you know, like that's not what I'm trying to do. Or it may be a piece that's in development and like what you're trying to do isn't really on the page yet. And they're trying to help you get to the place they think you're trying to go. And you have to see where they're trying to take you. Like, no, I'm actually trying to go this way. So that note doesn't really work. Or again, they could just be very much diagnosing something that needs to be solved. So, and I feel like one of the exhausting parts about live feedback sessions is it's often really hard to sort through all that, like literally as you're talking to someone right after they've given you a note. And when you're that vulnerable, and sometimes, you know, that's when it's important to kind of shut up and listen and maybe ask a few questions if you can formulate them in the moment, and then like step back and, you know, think about it for a while. And maybe, you know, after you've had some time to think, you have more intelligent questions to ask that person that could help them continue to give you the note. But, you know, there's no, when getting notes, there's no need to say yes or no. You know, I will absolutely do that, or I will shut you out entirely in that moment. Like, you know, you've got time. And I mean, I know I don't always feel that I have kind of the director skill of really thinking on my feet in a way that a lot of my collaborators do. So I often do kind of feel, if I'm surprised by a note, I rarely feel prepared to really sort through it all in that moment. I often do need to kind of just nod my head and think and come back to it. If it's one of those notes that like, it's kind of something that we both saw and I'm just trying to get your perspective on and you're helping me contextualize, you know, something that I already kind of know, that's much easier to talk through in a moment. But yeah, if you're surprised, I it might take some time.
Well, two things came up for me in that. The first thing is like, you are a writer, like, because you love revision. Like, that's what a writer does. You know, that's like, that's what you're made to do. You are here to write plays and write scripts and to work with language and work with people performing your language, you know? So that's something for our listeners to really understand as well. It's like, that's the gig. The work is the work. as my colleague Leith McPherson would say, the work is the work. You know, it's like, do the work. You know, and I think the other thing is, I would love to hear, what's the best note that you ever have been given that was like, fuck, that's a good note.
I mean, so one is just coming up immediately, so I'm just gonna say that one. It's a very good note. It's hard to say the best, I suppose, but it's also entertaining because of who it was, I guess. So a mentor of mine, especially around grad school, although we still stay in touch, is Edward Bond.
Edward Bond. You know, just Edward Bond.
Well, not everyone knows Edward Bond.
Who's Edward Bond? Okay, so if everyone doesn't know who Edward Bond is, who's Edward Bond?
Yeah. He is a great, great British playwright. I think could be kind of called the, you know... the godfather of, you know, British in-your-face theater. He was like a generation prior to like the Sarah Canes and the Mark Ravenhills.
What's in-your-face theater?
I'm gonna regret whatever definition I give.
Go for it.
I mean, Sarah Kane, Mark Ravenhill, Martin Kremp. It started out as this kind of very, you know, in your face style of drama.
What does that mean?
That came out of it's using we often think of shock value as something trite. I think that those playwrights use shock as something to get to something meaningful and deep. Either are in denial of or uncomfortable addressing.
It's not pornographic.
So it's not pornographic. No, it's showing us things that should shock us, and it's making sure we are shocked by them.
Yeah. So it's not ornamental. It's not a tagline. Yeah. It's something to shake you to the core and to show you your own human possibilities and capabilities.
Yeah. What I love about a lot of those plays is just, you know, we'll often go see a play about, say, war, and we'll walk out just like, talking in very kind of academic ways about what we just saw. And if you see a play about war by one of those playwrights, you would walk out like shell-shocked.
You'll walk out blasted. You will be blasted.
So Edward Bond, I was... How old was I when I got this note? I was 24 years old.
Oh, I need a little baby.
I was a little baby, Stephen. on a related note, the first thing Edward Bond ever said to me when we met was, "You don't look anything like I thought you would look like." And I said, "What does that mean, Edward?" So we had been corresponding via snail mail, literally snail mail.
Oh, wow, that's fun.
And wow.
He didn't have email all the time. And I was like, "What does that mean, Edward?" And he said, "You look 12.
Thanks.
Yep, exactly.
Thanks.
Anyway, he gave me a note, and this might have been the first day that it was one of the first couple times I met with him, and I was like still pinching myself that I was in the same room as this person.
Your 12-year-old self.
Yes, the 12-year-old Stephen got to be in the room with a lion of the British theater. It's very strange. Why did he let me see him? But he had just read an adaptation that I had written of Seneca's Thyestes, which is a very bloody play.
Can you give our readers a little idea of what of Seneca's Thyestes is like? Give them a little taste of
Seneca's Thyestes is a play about two brothers fighting over a throne. It's Atreus and Thyestes. Atreus being the
house of Atreus,
the first in the line of the house of Atreus. Thyestes, before the play had started, had an affair with Atreus's wife. He also tried to steal the throne from him.
So great.
To get revenge on his brother Thyestes, Atreus kills Thyestes' children, cooks them in
a stew
and feeds him the children.
Delicious.
Gets to the bottom of the dish, and there are like hands and stuff, and he realizes what he's just consumed, and then
it's the ultimate revenge. Delicious.
It's a very messy play, is I guess the point.
It's like cook, the thief, his wife, and her lover. My favorite line from that film is, "Try the cock, for you know where it's been." Continue. Yes.
Yes. Sorry. Sometimes I forget that they can't see me nodding on this episode. just nodding and grinning and smirking.
Yeah. And blushing.
And blushing. I'm constantly blushing. So it's a very messy play, and Edward Bond writes some very messy plays himself. And he told me, "Stephen, you're one of the most competent playwrights I've ever met." And when he said that, I was like,
"Yeah,
this is amazing." And then he was like, "That's not a compliment." He was just playing with me. He was just toying. He was having so much fun.
Oh, that's funny.
See me probably just like trembling. And he's like, no, you're a good playwright. But any good playwright can spill blood. Because to spill blood, one character has the knife, puts it into another character, the blood comes out, someone is always in control. Said, but what only a great playwright can do is spill soup. Because to spill soup, the soup has to take over. And that over time unlocked a lot of things for me about the dramaturgy of objects, about letting your characters take control away from you. It was a very, the play was just, it was just very ordered. It was like, it's a revenge play really lends itself to this of just like, there's a character that's very in control, very sadistic, and he's just twisting the knife over the course of the play. And the note was like, these things you're trying to write about are messier than that. He used the example of, he said his favorite line in all of Shakespeare was King Lear, when he says, "Pray you undo this button."
The very end.
Because for him, that that shows, yeah, he's like dying and he's like, you know, saying these like famous lines, and it looks like a throwaway line. Pray you undo this button, just asking to help him get some air. And he was saying that was evidence that Shakespeare was like really there with King Lear and understanding the physical reality that he was living with. That was not a note on a specific thing. That was just a note on like broadly what my writing was at the moment. And it was really helpful. And it diagnosed something that was, you know, a way that my writing could, you know, progress.
How do you take a note like that and apply it? Because it's so poetic, but how do you actually apply it for yourself?
I mean, for me, it's thinking about how people spill soup, you know. No one intends to spill soup. It just spills. I mean, it's almost, it feels like alchemy almost to talk about theater in this way, but like, you know, when an action is right, even when it seems like no one is in control. So my example was from Chekhov, and it's Yelena when she's leaving Astrov for the last time. It's Astrov from in Uncle Vanya. Yeah. Mm-hmm. She, you know, they're trying to figure out what to say. They're leaving forever. They're in love. And it's never going to be. And she sees one of his pencils on the desk and says, "I'll take this pencil to remember you by."
Mm-hmm.
And so much has built like that works so perfectly because of everything that, you know, the pencils have been throughout the play, and just, you know, there are layers upon layers of what that action means to like be a button on their relationship. Mm-hmm. But it's like totally like not something that like, you know, feels forced whatsoever. Mm. It's just, of course she would be looking about the room trying to figure out what to say. And of course his pencil is on the desk. So of course she picks it up. It's being in the room with the characters, I think, is what, you know.
And it's beautiful because it's a moment of intimacy as well.
It's
an extreme moment of intimacy that like only the object can reveal.
Everything you've been describing, is like the most human moments. The moment of Lear, undo this button, you know, dead daughter in his arms, and all he can think of in this moment is just, I need to breathe a little bit more. The pencil, it's just the most human, like, you know, it's not just great playwrights that it's great directors and great actors that make those moments as well. Like if you know, how many times have I seen an Uncle Vanya where that moment is just kind of a throwaway or it's lost, an actor doesn't pick it up. That's a really great note for any theater maker, to focus on the human stuff, focus on the human bits.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it's really easy to forget those things when you're writing plays that are like, high drama, poetic language, adaptations of Greeks or Shakespeare or et cetera, et cetera. It's very easy for them to get too heady, but like, we don't just live in our heads. We live in our bodies as well. And we live with objects as well. And those are all the things that theater lends itself to, is the meeting of all those things. So if you're just living in the characters' heads and only in their heads, then you're not using the form for everything that it can be.
Well, on that note, I think we should take a break because that's just, I mean, you sealed the deal with that one. So I guess Galtney's in the house, y'all. So how's that sound, boys? Shall we take a break and then come back and continue with Mr. Stephen Galtney?
Yes.
Excellent. Okay, take it away, Purple Planet. Keyword, planeta. And we're back. We're back with Steven Gottney.
I got a song.
You got a jingle, baby.
Planet who gets songs. I got a jingle. Oh, you got man. A jingle. I've made it. I have made it.
Well, look, I think since we've got this, it's the Gottney Hour, I think we should also talk about our response to your response about theater and being in the space with theaters and biting the ear off of an audience member because the theater's so good. What's your response to our response to your response?
I should have gone back and listened to this. now I'm trying to remember what our back and forth actually was. I think if I remember right, and correct me if I'm wrong, so that, you know, the intrepid number one and number two fans don't go back and replay, you know, episodes and realize that this is all wrong. I feel like what you took, because it came from an episode about the proscenium,
mm-hmm.
I think your response seemed to be thinking that I was advocating for the proscenium stage, or at least that's how I took it,
mm-hmm.
which is not what I meant to say. I think I was really more talking about
live
wanting
theater.
To get back to in-person yeah. theater. That's the live yeah. theater. That's what I meant by wanting to be shoulder to shoulder with people. That's what we're missing, and that because people's there we go, it's coming back. Sorry about that. Because people's, you know, image that they often think about when they think of theater is a proscenium stage. That is actually what people are going to long for and have been longing for all this time, or think they've been longing for all this time, and that we need to, you know, maybe meet them at that place of longing and understand it, and you know, not say you don't want those things, but instead say this is why a different type of theater can give you all those things and more. That's, I don't know if that's going to make any sense mm-hmm. to people.
No, yeah,
listen to those episodes, but yeah.
And Adam had a very clear response to that. What was your response to that, Mr. Marple?
Burn it down. Burn it all down.
Burn it down.
No. I mean, yes, I absolutely agree with you in that response. I think that is absolutely true. My only kind of caveat to all of that is they're not going to ever not think about the proscenium unless we give them something else to think about. And so, yes, of course, everybody's going to think about the proscenium theater until there are other options that are better for them. And if we open back up and put them back in a proscenium theater, then we're just reinforcing the idea of the proscenium theater instead of saying, after a year of evaluating safety and health and audience interaction, we've decided to go with X model or Y model instead. And here's why. And, you know, we're 4 months from 2022. Broadway has...
Are we really 4 months from 2022? Oh my God.
We're still processing 2020, and 2022 is just waiting in the wings.
And, oh my God.
And Broadway has only just opened up, barely. We don't know. We don't know how long any of this is going to last with Delta out there and whatever else is in the wings. We're not done with this. Like it's almost like the universe says, no, guys, you still haven't gotten it right. I'm going to give you some more time to figure it out on everything.
Oh my God.
Right. I know. So
that was so painful. I've actually not dealt with the 4 month factor. Thank you, Adam Marple.
Now I've got to
think about that in my quarantine. I was having such a wonderful Zen moment.
continue to have a wonderful Zen moment, but 2022 just went away. 2020 lasted 8 years. God. 2022 just zipped by. 2 weeks ago, we did a show. Remember that?
2021.
Yeah. 2021 is gone. Remember 2 weeks ago when we did a show? That was like 2-3 weeks ago.
Yes, sounds about right. Yeah. Timeline. Yes, yeah. I think that's
Wow. Well, now that Adam has brought in the 4 month factor, what kind of theater is going to happen, you two? What do you think?
I think whatever can happen.
Yeah. I think people try to abandon Zoom theater, and they try and rush back into the proscenium as quickly as possible because it's comfortable and it's safe and it's what they know. And that's going to be where the problems come. Whatever was learned in this last year and a half is going to be tried to be forgotten. And I think it's going to rear its ugly head and hurt us all.
Well, I think because we were forced to do Zoom, it wasn't a choice.
I know.
We were all forced in that space. And so now it's like, I'm free. It's like a mouse being trapped in a hole. Like, and then you leave and the mouse butt runs out, you know? And I think that's going to be the hardest thing for us because, you know, after our conversation with Steve Wong about the interactiveness of Zoom theater and the exploration that we had, I'm a little bit kind of sold on a little bit more exploration now. It was like, I was having senses that I have when I'm in the room working in the same way with that exercise. So I'm torn. I was really against Zoom theater. And now I'm like, I've got a new spark of curiosity after, you know, having the master here.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I anticipated this conversation would come up, and I came up with a metaphor that I think I like for this.
Okay.
Because I have not heard at this time of this recording, I have not heard the conversation with Mr. Wong. But I am also quite weary of virtual theater at the moment. And I miss in person, which is what that comment was kind of about. Like, I miss being shoulder to shoulder with people. And, you know, all throughout the pandemic, I've been having like At first, I was like, oh, this is cool, this virtual theater thing. Like, it's, you know, it's a tool that we have. We can keep making work. This is great. And as time went on and it started being referred to as, like, the future of theater and, like, this is the way things are headed. Mm-hmm. Like, I started having this, like, visceral, like, no, that's not it. That's not true. Yeah. That's not true reaction. But it does a lot of interesting things, and it brings in audiences that would be difficult to reach. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there are positives to it. And I think, I don't know if I've decided this as like a truth about the world, but I've at least decided it as a way that I think I feel right myself as an artist thinking about virtual theater versus live theater. And that is that they're just different forms. Mm-hmm. They're just different mediums. And they're mediums that happen to be practiced by a lot of the same practitioners. Uh-huh. In the same way that sculpture and painting maybe are, you know, both done by the same visual artists. Doing one doesn't mean a success. If we suddenly had a shortage of paint and we just stopped painting for a year or 2 years,
yeah,
and everyone moved into sculpture, and like maybe suddenly like sculpture had been like not something a lot of people had been doing, and suddenly like sculpture is great, and it has, I mean, pretend it has all sorts of benefits that we're not even going to define here, but it does things, it brings in new audiences that you wouldn't normally bring in, et cetera, et cetera. And then paint suddenly comes back on the market. Like, you're not going to not paint because sculpture was successful. You're gonna do both.
Right.
And perhaps most importantly, that time you spent sculpting might make you a better painter. Uh-huh. And you might look at the audiences that sculpting brought in and be like, oh, how can I make painting more interesting for them? Like, why did they? You ask questions. Why was sculpture a thing that they were really into or that they could access that when they couldn't access painting, and it might change the way you paint, but it doesn't stop you from painting.
I love that because Galtney, it's like, it's one of those things of like, you're always going to be an artist. And so like, okay, now you have this limitation. How do you continue to stay, keep the same integrity that you have with all of your other forms that you're comfortable in, and having to use this new form, or it's not even new anymore, this particular form, and still be able to find your development as a soul and an artist, you know? And I think that's the thing that's the most important, because what happens is this like good, bad binary that gets put on it. It's like, Zoom bad, live theater good, you know? And it's like, but like you're still the artist in both those worlds. There's, your body is still in both those worlds. How do you delve deeper into that process? And the things that are coming up for you on why you dislike it so much, maybe could be something that you could actually investigate to deepen the quality of your work, that you don't have the crutches of the familiarity of live performance. I don't know. I'm just throwing that out there.
I'll see your art-based analogy and raise you another art-based analogy. This was a conversation that I had with Leon Ingelsrud from City Company very, very early in the pandemic, before, you know, anybody was even really doing Zoom theater. This was like maybe a month into it. And he said, you know, when photography came around, when, you know, basically painters were making their bread and butter from portraiture. Mm. They were drawing, mm-hmm. they were painting people. And then when photography came around, it was so much easier to just go get your picture taken than to have your portrait painted. And it put a lot of artists kind of out of business for a while, until those artists realized, oh, I no longer have to paint portraits. Now I'm so much more free to do all these other things. And that's something that I think that we could think about as well, of going like, oh, now that I have this medium, I no longer have to do plays around a couch. Or I no longer have to do this kind of play because it doesn't work on this medium anymore. I no longer have to do those things. I don't have to worry about having space issues, because I can have 1,000 people or 10,000 people all over the world, or 4, and it still works if I write it that way, to be that way. Mm. I keep trying to have the conversation about, do both. It's not a binary choice of I either do this or I do that, but like, I think we need to be, and this may just fall in the director's hands more than anything else, but we need to do both, have both happening at the same time for different audiences. There's an audience that is going to see it live, face-to-face, breathing the same air. And there's going to be an audience that isn't there, that's getting a different experience that's just as good, but different. And that's going to be the thing of going, if we write something, it has to do for both audiences. If we adapt something, it has to be for both audiences. If we choose a classic play, it's got to be for both audiences. And the actor can do their work because the camera can pick them up and follow them around. We do a 3-camera setup or whatever it is. Or the actor maybe does interact with the camera and the audience. And the director's got to figure that out. And the playwright's got to figure that out. And I think that's probably the hard, horrible world we're actually heading to.
Well, I think from a training standpoint, it's like one of those things of like, you know, it's training you to be filmed. It's training you to be in that world. And honestly, that's, if you want to make money as an actor, you need to learn how to be in front of a camera and live in that world. Yeah. Theater is great. Theater is awesome. But in general, it doesn't make you the kind of money to survive, you know, in general, that film and television does. You just gotta be realistic, you know? And you can put yourself into that mindset of like, I'm just developing those skills of being really comfortable in this kind of environment, you know? That's just what I'm thinking as well, you know, on a practical level. as an educator, you know, but that's, you know, an educator that works in the industry as well. So, you want to not be a barista, keep finding ways to develop your craft. And if the only thing that's available for you is that damn Zoom and a laptop, go for it.
I mean, I'm trying to decide if I disagree.
Come on, give it to me.
What you just said, Adam. So I might change my mind as we talk. I'm just going to talk this out. But I don't know if I think we should make live theater as accessible as possible to as many people as possible.
Yes. Amen.
Absolutely. I don't know if something in me says that we shouldn't lie to people and say that it's going to be just as good.
I agree 100%. Was Adam saying just as good? Were you saying just as good, Adam?
He was saying not worse but different. So here's why I say that, and not because
it's not just as good, and it's not.
Well, I think the medium of live theater is like the communal presence that exists in a room. And I think that you are literally working in two mediums at once if you're going to somehow bring that experience into people's homes on a screen. So maybe we can say that it almost feels like we're putting someone who's blind in front of a painting and giving them an audio description, and we're making it accessible in that way, and then we're telling them it's just as good.
Ooh, that's a potent image.
But ask,
like, we're being as accessible as possible, and maybe they can't be there because they're, for whatever reason, the access is not there. They can't be there because of a disability. They can't be there because they're geographically not in the same place, but they're not experiencing the play. And like, we're growing an audience and we're being accessible as accessible as possible. And part of being accessible as artists is also making virtual theater that is specifically to go into people's computer screens in their room. And that is a different form. And that is bringing, you know, dramatic narratives or non-narrative pieces to people as well. But I don't know if we can say it's just as good. Or maybe it's like a specific type of piece that is just as good. But to say that every play, say that we're going to do King Lear and it's going to be just as good somehow to someone in, you know, the South Pole who can't be there, you know, and it's going to be just as good somehow on their computer screen as it would be as if they were in the room with those actors.
This is totally making me think of Chan as well, because remember, Adam, when a long, long time ago, back in the old days, you had brought this up. You had brought up like having like, you know, live performances and also having like access for people around the world to watch the performance. And Chan, I remember when I told Chan about this, Chan went ballistic. Our Juilliard grad was like, no fucking way. You don't make it to the show, you don't get the show.
Again, but again, we're
but we're I'm not joining him.
We are all here assuming that there are people who have seen theater and have the ability to see theater.
Mm-hmm.
Right? The blind person who is standing in front of the painting getting an audio description has no other choice but to have the audio description of the play. And for him, that is the best opportunity for him. And
it's the best. I don't think it's equal though. Like, we're not saying it's as good.
But again, we're basing it off of our experience of being in the space and having the opportunity to be in the space. If you don't have the opportunity to be in the space and see the work and be a part of the work, then yes, this is actually, because there is nothing else to base it off of. It's if I have seen this and I have that opportunity, then yes, I understand that I enjoy this better, but if I have no opportunity, and this is all I have, then this is fantastic for me.
Okay, so Adam, I'm going to say, I'm going to bring up Romero Castellucci. Mm-hmm. I've never seen a Romero Castellucci performance live. Mm-hmm. I've only seen recordings of his work. And I am riveted. I am blown away. I am beyond inspired. I am like, this is incredible. Yes. And I think seeing it live will just be, you know, a sensory overload in all the great, in all the best ways, right?
Sure.
So I see what you're saying in the relativity of what the best theater could be, or the relativity of what the best experience can be.
Yes.
Okay, I understand that.
I will always fight for live in-person theater. I'm not giving up on it, believe me, I'm not. But, but like I said, we've taught people for a year and a half that there's another option. And if I can now watch something at the Berliner Ensemble or the Metropolitan Opera or you know, Sydney Playhouse or wherever, and it's thought of and done well for me to watch in this medium, then I'll watch it. Then I will watch it, because I will not have the opportunity to go someplace else. I will not have the opportunity to do those things. Yeah.
I don't think I disagree with anything. I think we're just saying different terms. Like, I think I agree with everything you just said.
No, Stephen, we're at war with each other. We're no longer friends.
We're not friends. This is over. Bye.
Oh, audience is about to get Greek. The blood is coming out. The spilled soup. Somebody spilled the soup. Somebody just spilled the soup.
Adam, someone's about to bring some soup to you. I sent it to Egypt. No, I just
Did you just do an Amazon like Prime's soup delivery to Egypt?
I'm sorry, we don't have...
I really should have thought
we don't have Amazon in Egypt. I'm sorry. So, I got lost.
It's probably good.
What were you going to say, Goldie?
I just keep coming back to it's in a different medium. It's giving the same story through a different medium. Yeah. And maybe that's just terminology. Maybe, I mean, I agree with everything you said about like people want to experience a story in the best way that they are able to, given wherever they are or whoever they are. And we should be as accessible and as excellent for as many of those people as possible. That's absolutely true.
This is not a perfect analogy, but you know, I think that reading a book on paper, having it in my hands, is the best way to experience a book. Booty loves audiobooks.
I do. I live for an audiobook.
I actually had to come
to terms with that it's actually reading. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, it's like
right.
It's the whole journey of like having a book in your hand, reading it all the way to, from cover to cover, and like, but like I retain way more of the information when I listen to it. I retain even more when I listen to it and follow along with the book in my hand. So it's like, yeah, I love audiobooks. I live for an audiobook.
Yeah. So it's not a perfect analogy, but it is still I'm getting the story the best way that I possibly can at this time right now. I still think, you know, if we make really amazing live in-person theater and somebody watches it digitally and we do it really amazingly well for them as well, I would love, if I see something digitally and I really, really like it, I want to then go physically and see what's that experience like. As you're talking about with Romeo Castellucci's work, like it is, anybody can watch any of his work right now online and go, holy shit, this guy is operating on another level. This is incredible. Mm. And then you go, I want to see that live. And when you go there, you are getting something completely different. And that's cool. Maybe that helps grow the audience. Maybe that helps, you know, creates a different community. But I also think people aren't going to come to the theater no matter what.
Yeah, especially if they're scared.
Yeah. Or they just can't physically, literally. Physically can't. You know, they can't.
And theater is a geographically specific thing. Like, you know, if it can only be in person, it is, you know, people get to go based on the privilege of where they live.
Yeah.
I think that's something that these, like, you know, virtual and streaming and et cetera, performances have brought in a lot of, especially in America, like, you know, wide open spaces where most of theater happens in New York and Chicago. You know,
I'm just thinking about something here, because as we're talking about this, I'm trying to think of other analogies of, you know, sports. You know, of course, everybody, you can be in the stadium. It's a geographically specific thing. It's a very privileged thing to be able to have a ticket or a season, a subscriber to a football game or a baseball game. But like, if you can't go to that stadium, you still watch the sport. And you can watch it specifically alone, but people love to be around other people watching that game as well. Maybe we encourage watching parties so that there are
together,
so that there are smaller communities of those who can get together.
We do it for RuPaul's Drag Race.
You're right, exactly.
Why can't we do it for theater?
Right, exactly.
Well, boys, I think we should take a break and then come and talk about our radio play season.
Yes,
our
yes.
festival. Yeah?
Yes.
Because I feel like we are climbing up a hill that is being conducted by Paula Abdul. We take two steps forward, and then I take two steps back. Opposites attract. Two steps forward, I take two steps back. Opposites attract. Yeah, so I think we should just take a break, cool down, and come back and talk about our beautiful radio play season. Yeah, sound good to you boys?
Yes.
Take it away, Purple Planet! We're back. Thank you, Purple Planet. We're back, and we're going to talk about the radio plays, and I think I'm going to pass it over to Adam Marple.
Yes, so we're talking about the Audio New Play Festival that we have coming up next, basically. Yes, so starting next week, you're going to be starting to hear the five plays that we have been working on. That the playwrights wrote specifically for this festival, and Stephen was dramaturging, working with the playwrights the entire summer, and you will hear the fruits of their labors soon. So this Thursday, we will have Christina Pakomova, the playwright for Thief, and she'll be talking about her work that you will hear next Monday. And then Rachel Chin and Galatea, Michelle Miller with Power Girl Support Group, Colette Cullen with Been There, Done That, and Justin Tan and Sabina, I still don't know your last name, with Tales from Arcadia. You know Sabina's last name, right, Stephen?
Sabina's like Cher.
Yeah.
Sabina.
I've definitely got it in my email.
I know that's the thing. It's like I've only just had email communication and her email.
I think we should just keep it as Sabina.
Okay, Sabina, that's it. You're
Sabina
now just
will love that. Actually, she'll love that. She's an icon.
There you go. That's
she's
it.
She's iconoclast.
There you go.
Right.
Yeah.
It's just Justin Tan and Sabina.
Yeah. Exactly.
Sabina.
So Stephen, what has the process been like for you as a playwright? Watching other playwrights create from scratch sometimes, or sometimes adapting and doing their work, and then seeking your guidance as a dramaturg. What's this process been like?
I mean, I've enjoyed it, and it's been fun to watch, you know, a number of people use the medium for different, you know, for different things. I mean, we said kind of at the outset that we were here as much or as little as they wanted for advice. So I've had a lot of very sustained, intense contact with some people, and with others, they were like,
I'm good.
Pretty much fine. Yeah. Already. We're good. And it also is because, you know, different scripts were at different stages of development.
Right.
A couple of the scripts that we took, you know, were pretty much there already. And, you know, there were other scripts that were very early on. So obviously I had more contact with people who were operating under the latter situation. But yeah, I mean, there's a real joy, I think. I mean, we started this podcast out talking about notes, but there's a real joy in helping people, for me, maybe not always for them, but in trying to help people find the path that they want to take. You know, that's kind of the key of the process of giving notes, is to not try to help them write the play you would write, but to help them write the play that they want to write. So yeah, I kind of had a blast. It was good to get to know some different people, and I'm excited for people to, you know, get to experience some work by playwrights other than me. Yeah, I think it's going to be a fun few weeks or five weeks, I guess. Yeah.
So what's the one thing that you are going to do different next year?
Yeah.
Like in theater as a writer broadly?
Well, just from this process, because when we do our second festival,
second annual
as a mentor.
Yeah.
Audio festival.
Yes, yes.
Not just everything. That's an easier question to answer.
Tell me, what are you going to do with your life, please?
Yeah.
Yes, tell me now. I think it would be good to... I feel like it would be nice if we as a group maybe gave even more lead time to people. I feel like it. What's interesting? I mean, I think part of this is questioning like what we want to do with the audio play festival. I think we came in, and correct me if you guys had like different understandings of it, but I think we thought that we were going to really come in and really collaborate with everyone, maybe more than we did with some of them. It might be good that there were a couple that were already done. I feel like we, as a dramaturg, I feel like I might not have had as much time as I wanted with a couple of the projects. And by that, I mean, I feel like they might have wanted a little bit more time as well. And some of the other projects, I feel like we could just, you know, put straight up there. From a notes process, it's always about time, you know, and how much time you need. So I don't know. I mean, every project was unique. I don't know that there's like something of like, you know, we made some sort of like huge error that we would correct.
I think more time is great. Yeah. I think that now that we know what it is, I think we can have a lot more time for development.
Yeah.
I will say, like, I think I would like to have maybe a session with each person before we really dig into the play to get to know them personally a bit more. So that maybe that first conversation, especially with someone I haven't met before, which is true of all the people for me. I know you guys knew some of the people, but instead of that first talk being a feedback session, which involves a lot of vulnerability on the writer's part, it might be good to have a talk that's like feels much more on a level kind of playing field, where they're not having to be that vulnerable, and where it's not about me giving notes. It's easy, you know, you can say all the right things of being like, you know, this is just my opinion and you don't have to take it all. And like, you know, it's, you know, your play, you know, better than anyone else. And those are all true things. But then as a writer, when you get the notes, there's always like a, there's always a, it's always easy to feel like there's some sort of like imbalance. Especially if the, you know, the dramaturg is a company member of the producing company. So I really wanted that not to be the case, and I hope that it wasn't, but I feel like a way to like really establish a relationship in advance might be just to meet them as people before you talk to them about their play.
That's great advice.
Yeah. Do you think, I mean, this was our first time doing this. So of course this was a learning process for us as well. And I'm just writing these things down as we're saying this, of like, as we think about this going into next year, because if we are going to give them more lead time, then we have about 3 months before we announce next year's New Play Festival.
Yes, because we only have 4 more months till next year.
Exactly.
And we only have 8 more years left on the planet.
Exactly. We had said, we hadn't really said that it needs to be a completely brand new, never produced play before. And so we do have some pieces in the festival this year that have been done before, have been produced, have been heard other places. And you were saying some of that was actually really quite interesting, that they were in different levels of the process. Do you think we should, in the future, limit it to brand new completely for this festival, can never be produced anywhere else? Or do you think that's limiting too much and could possibly be really harmful for the playwright?
I mean, I think that's difficult. I feel like a lot of festivals do that.
Yeah.
A lot of, you know, submission processes are like that, you know, never produce play because everyone wants to do new plays. And that's hard sometimes because, you know, it takes a long time to write a play. Yeah. So it's helpful to be able to submit to multiple things at once. And every playwright wants their work done by multiple companies and organizations because you learn more about it every time it gets done by different people. Mm. I mean, it might make sense to... I mean, we might decide to, you know, that this festival is about development, you know? And about developing new plays. And that doesn't necessarily mean it's never been done, you know, before, but it might mean that it needs significant adaptation for the form, or it might mean that the playwright's like, I did this play at this other place. This is how I want to use the time to, you know, to change it. We might decide that, if original writing is not what they're doing, then the rewriting is part of the process. Or not. Or you know, maybe you also don't want to back yourself into a corner where it's like you could get a play that's just like amazing and you want to be a part of it and it's done. Or it's very close to done. So maybe we don't want to do that. But
it might just access. Access. Mm-hmm. I think the key is that we want to provide access for artists to get their an opportunity to develop a skill, an opportunity to have an outreach for their work, and an opportunity to be pushed a little harder than they have ever anticipated with their writing.
Mm.
So access.
I'm writing all this.
So did you hear that, audience? Do you hear that, listeners? We want to provide a space for you. So if you were thinking about doing something this year, but weren't able to do it, we're coming back and we're going to do it again next year. So start thinking about stories you want to tell, which I think this is actually the perfect opportunity for provocations. Yeah.
Sure.
Galtney, let's have you go first. Do you have a provocation?
I do, and it let's say it. This might sound like it's cheating, but it's not, I promise. I want people to make work. And I want them to do it now. Like, we should all be doing it now. And it's real. I'm almost saying this to myself as much as anyone else. So I feel like I need to be provoked to do this, so maybe someone else does as well. And it's, we are in a time of transition and in a time of uncertainty, even more so than at the beginning of the pandemic, where it's just like, we're doing virtual theater. We're stuck inside. This is what we're doing. You know, before the pandemic, it was like, we make live events and that's what we're doing. And, you know, we're at a time where it's like, everything feels unstable. And it's like, well, by the time I'm done with this, are people going to want to watch a virtual theater piece? Maybe not. Are we, you know, wherever I live, for whatever reason, like, am I going to be able to stage a live piece when it's done? Because these things take a while to make, you know, no matter what part of the process you, whether you're a writer or an actor or a director, et cetera. And I think it's very easy to be tempted to just kind of stall and be like, I'll start making things again when I know what we're doing as a community. And I think we just keep telling stories, and, you know, it might not work. Like, you might do something and it's like, the way that I did it, it made sense like 3 months ago, and now it doesn't really make any sense. But what you created in that time is going to be helpful to your growth as an artist. You're going to learn from those very unique circumstances that you were in that moment, and there might be a kernel that you can take for the piece that does get performed. So just like, these times of uncertainty are perhaps, sometimes there are times where art doesn't happen, and sometimes there are times when it really flowers and just don't. I feel like we just have to keep pushing ourselves, so that just in case now is a time where there's a confluence of events where you as a person can really make something meaningful. You don't want to miss it. So just keep making work. Keep trying.
That's a really good provocation. I love it. I love it. I'm going to jump on board. I'm going to give a provocation where in the vein of the audio play season, and I'm just working with the audio-ness of it. I want you to commune with a playwright. And what I mean by this is, I want you to set aside 3 hours, 4 hours, lock out the entire world, and I want you to pick a play. And I want you to read it from cover to cover out loud. And take your time with it. And sink into the different characters. And read the stage directions. Read everything aloud. And see what it does for you as an artist, as a writer, as a director, and as an actor. So often we're always trying so quickly, trying to get through things because we're so busy. I got to read this play because I got to, you know. I want you to actually take your time and commune with the playwright and really be the playwright's audience. You actually get an opportunity to be the playwright's audience when you take the time to read the play aloud and read it all the way through. No interruptions, no breaks. Yes, you can give yourself an intermission and go to the toilet, but that's it. Get rid of your phone, get rid of everything. I actually recommend doing it late night when everyone's asleep, so you don't have any interruptions. Give yourself, instead of going out, you know, and so many people are on lockdown these days, give yourself a late weekend night and sit up and read a play aloud in a sacred space. It's a sacred moment. Play reading is a sacred moment, and I want you to commune with the playwright and hear the sounds of the words, because plays are meant to be performed. They're not meant to be read. So see what happens to you when that happens, when you hear the language, when you feel the language in your body, when you're moving through the given circumstances of the characters, all the characters. So read it for its story, not for just one character, but for the whole story. See what it does to you. That's my provocation.
Good provocation. Nice. Okay, my provocation is a thought experiment for you. if you are taking Stephen's provocation to just start working on something, if you're taking Budi's provocation to read it out loud, if you are able, if you are open, wherever you are in the world, and you are working on something live, or if you are working on something digital, my thought experiment provocation for you is think about what the other version of that is. You're live. You're in rehearsals right now. You're going to be on stage live in person with other people. As a thought experiment, think about what the digital version of that is, not in negation to what you're doing, in conjunction with what you're doing. So your live version continues. What does the digital version look like? So you're not having to restage what you're already doing. How do you create a digital version that is something as good as the in-person? And if you're doing something digital, as we did with Limb from Limb, if you had to turn that to a live in-person thing, what does that look like? Without negating the digital, how do you do both? How do you do both where they don't interfere with each other? So you're not having to restage something or rethink your main thrust of design, but that they live in harmony with each other. That's a thought experiment that I want.
That's a fun exercise. That's fun.
I'm going to push this idea forever. I don't care what Chan says. I don't care what Steven says. I think we have to think about this thing. So,
well, you know, it doesn't matter anyway. In 8 years, we're not going to have a planet. So,
right.
I feel like our audience is going to think that we had like a big.
No, we didn't know.
I don't disagree.
I know.
It's so good to have a third person on just to bounce off of. Yeah. It's so good to have you. Will you come back and play with us, Stephen?
Oh, please. I enjoy being here to play with you.
Yay! So, Adam, how will we know if anyone is going to do any of these, has done or going to do or will not do any of these provocations?
Here's what they're going to do. We're not going to say that they, you know, if they want to. No, they are going to go to speakpipe.com/theater of others. They're going to go to speakpipe.com/theater of others, theater of others, all one word, theater with an R-E, and they're going to leave us a 90-second voicemail telling us
how much
work that they're making and how they're making it for both mediums and what play they read out loud or whatever other questions or provocations they may have based off of anything else. That's what they're going to do. And they're also...
We really care. We want to know.
They're also going to go to podcast@theaterofothers.com and leave a long email, a long diatribe, a treatise, an essay, the first chapter of their novel. That's what they're going to leave that there, and then they're going to go to our website, our Facebook, and our Instagram, and
on the gram, we're on the gram,
and they're going to leave messages for us.
And you need
there.
To subscribe, y'all. They need to subscribe. If you like listening to our podcast, you have to subscribe.
That's
subscribe,
right.
Subscribe.
These conversations aren't one-off conversations. They build on each other, and we reference things that happened in the past, and you want to be able to hear all those things and know what we're talking about and know all the great things that's coming up, especially the Audio New Play Festival that starts next week. You want to be able to hear these playwrights. You want to be able to hear these plays. You want to be a part of this conversation and find out these great interviews that we've got coming up in this season too. So subscribe.
And if you like it, you have to be like my Uber driver and give us five star, please.
That's right.
Because you know what? In the middle of the morning, in the middle of the night, I ain't too proud to beg. Five star.
Yes, that's right. We don't get Oprah on the show until you give us five stars. So we have 2 5-star reviews.
Oprah and then TLC. And TLC. Missing one girl.
Yes. We have T and C.
We have TL.
No.
TNC?
TNC.
Yeah, TC.
L is no longer TC. With us. R.I.P. R.I.P. Yes. L.
We love you, left eye.
It's really fun to be here to watch you guys say the things that you say every week. Now I get to see what your facial expressions are. Now I'm always going to imagine what Booty looks like when he says five stars.
Yeah. And how I just roll my eyes while it's all happening. Yeah.
As if you've never heard him do it before.
Well, it's so good to be with the three of us all together. Isn't it? If I say so myself.
Yeah.
It's so good to be with the three of us.
It's so good to be with me. Together, guys.
Oh my god, it's so amazing. Oh my god. I love you both so much. Thank you for coming on, Goldie. Thank you. Thanks for coming back on, buddy.
Thank you for having me. It's been fun.
Adam,
yeah.
Take care of Egypt.
I'll try.
Goldie, take care of New York. And I'll take care of Melbourne.
Okay.
And listeners, we'll be back soon. Bye.
Thanks for joining us this week on the Theater Brothers podcast. Make sure to visit our website, theaterbrothers.org, where you can subscribe to the show in iTunes, Stitcher, or via RSS, so you'll never miss a show. While you're at it, if you found value in this show, we'd appreciate a rating on iTunes. Or if you'd simply tell a friend about the show, that would help us out too. A special thank you to Purple Planet for the music you've heard. The Theater Brothers creates a shared community of artists and audiences for the purposes of exploring the most profound issues of our lives and times. We believe the play watches the audience. The audience is necessary, and they are witness to what happens. And you get to be witness to us making that happen. The purpose of this podcast is to open up our process and let you in. We're peeling back the curtain, so to speak, and encouraging you to follow along, to ponder, prod, and question, to join us and criticize us if need be. Being a witness is no passive task and requires much from you. Are you up for the journey? Be sure to tune in next week for our next journey.